Turkey and ISIS today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Turkish officials say ISIS is responsible for the Istanbul airport attacks. To some, that's not surprising.
Turkey has essentially acted as ISIS's rear base since the rise of this group in 2012 and 2013.
And a Turkish family in the U.S. decides not to go back for the summer. They ask their relatives in Turkey about that choice.
And then you know what they said? They said, don't come, don't come.
Plus, a man sees a Ford Mustang parked outside. He thinks it's named after the part of Nepal where he grew up. So he waits for the driver.
I'm so excited to see this person. I thought this is from Mustang. I waited for 2 hours and then...
The rest of the story coming up here on The World. Glad to be back with you today. There is a proverb in Turkish, feed a crow and it will pluck out your eyes. That may be something Turkey's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, is considering these days, and here's why. Turkish authorities blame ISIS for the deadly bombing on Istanbul's main airport on Tuesday, but until recently, Erdogan didn't seem to consider ISIS a major threat to Turkey. Some say he even provided tacit support for ISIS as part of his effort to help Syrian rebels oust President Bashar al-Assad.
There's also an American proverb, lie down with dogs and you might get up with fleas.
Rukmini Kalamaki wrote about Turkey's complicated relationship with ISIS. For today's New York Times, she's in Istanbul.
So Turkey has essentially acted as ISIS's rear base since the rise of this group in 2012 and 2013. Since then, Istanbul, the international airport in Istanbul, which is the very one that they have now bombed, was the main route that foreign fighters used to get to Turkey and then overland to cross into Syria. When I was with rebel forces that are fighting ISIS in northern Syria last year, they told me that when they are able to kill ISIS fighters on the battlefield, they often find ID cards or passports on them that show that they transited through Turkey, Turkish entry stamps. And so the question now is, why has ISIS decided to retaliate in this very dramatic way? Surely they must know that by doing so, that there is a danger that Turkey could crack down and could shut down the border, making it much harder for their fighters to get in and out.
I mean, just because ISIS fighters used Ataturk Airport to get to where they wanted to go, I mean, couldn't that just be convenience? Does it necessarily mean the Turkish government supported them?
You know, this is a question that we've grappled with in our own reporting. When I was in southern Turkey, it becomes very hard to tie what's happening with ISIS in Turkey to the government. It's hard to distinguish between them just turning a blind eye and them actively supporting them, right? I certainly was never able to make the stronger statement. But what is clear is that they're transiting through Turkey. They're using southern Turkey as a place where they go for R&R, for hospital treatment. They use Western unions there to receive money from their families in Europe. And many of the ISIS fighters that end up being captured do so with Turkish cell phone numbers on them. So they were using the Turkish cell network.
When did all this change with the Turkish government and ISIS? When did the Turkish government turn against ISIS?
The turning point, I think, was last year, in the summer of last year, when the United States negotiated using the Incirlik Air Base in southern Turkey to carry out sorties over Iraq and Syria and to carry out airstrikes against the group. If you look at Dabiq, their flagship magazine, immediately after that deal was sealed, the next issue of Dabiq, their cover image was President Erdogan, the president of Turkey, leaning in and speaking to Obama. So this image of the president of Turkey in a metaphorical embrace with their number one enemy, that to me was a signal that they were moving towards essentially designating Turkey one of their enemies and one of their targets. And since then, we have seen an uptick in attacks that have been blamed on ISIS. But the interesting thing, Marco, is that in Turkey, ISIS has never claimed any of its major suicide bombings. It's always officials who end up identifying it as ISIS, while ISIS remains silent on the subject.
And what does that tell us?
You know, it's a very puzzling thing because, as you know, this is a group that loves to tout its slaughter and that is not shy at all of claiming the attacks they have done elsewhere, even some of the most horrific attacks. So the analysts I've spoken to see it as a case of them wanting to have their cake and eating it too, right? That they want to still be able to have access through Turkey for their fighters, for their supplies. And at the same time, they want to send a message to Turkey. They want to punish the country for its growing rapprochement with the West. But they're afraid, I think, to do it in a way that would be too strident and might prompt Turkey to retaliate.
That was Rukmini Kalamaki in Istanbul with the New York Times. A lot of Turks living here in the U.S. travel home during the summer for vacation, to see family, but now some of them say they're staying away. Safiye recently completed her master's at NYU, and for safety, she does not want to use her last name. Safiye, as a Turk living abroad, how do you feel about these attacks, especially now that they're happening so frequently, it seems?
2 days ago, we heard the news. It's very sad. We're shocked and horrified about what's happening. There's a lot of feeling about vulnerability in our family back in Turkey. When I heard the news, I was with a bunch of Turkish Americans, Turkish friends here in New York, and we just started getting notifications about on WhatsApp and Twitter about, you know, there's a bomb attack in Istanbul. And suddenly, a couple hours later, the government blacked social media channels, and we were really nervous about what's happening there.
Are you going to visit your home country? Are you going to visit Turkey this summer?
I did not go to Turkey this summer, mainly because of what's happening in Turkey. A couple of months ago, when we were planning our trip to Turkey with my family, which is a very usual thing. Every summer, no exception, we go back to Turkey, spend 1 month or 2 months.
And your immediate family lives here in the States with you, correct?
Yes, they are with me in the United States. We go back, we will spend some time with grandparents and then travel around the country. This year, my parents said they were thinking of not going because the country is unstable and there's a feeling that the country is not secure anymore. We had that feeling when we visited Turkey last summer as well, because to be frank, there was more than 10 attacks that happened in Turkey this year and more than 250 people died. Yeah. And my dad said, you know, I really don't want to take any risk. So we basically decided not to have a trip overseas to our homeland, unfortunately.
How do your family members in Turkey feel about you're not going this summer?
Me and my sister were really upset. And, you know, we called our family, and I'm from the capital. And then we kind of complained that our parents don't want to come back. They were not only supportive, they said, don't come. If it's possible, stay in America.
Wow.
And even we can plan to come visit you in the U.S. That moment, I realized this is serious. And really, it's in our best benefit to stay here this summer. And I hope we can return back to Turkey in the upcoming summers or in the future.
I mean, you're just not wanting to use your last name suggests a certain level of fear. Are you worried about your family members in Turkey?
People in Turkey who are frank about the political process or who criticize the government in social media or out in the public are being jailed. And this is a serious concern, both in my end and for my family. There was a couple students who got jailed for tweeting about the president. So I really don't want to take this chance of putting my name out there.
Do you criticize the Erdogan government on social media?
I mean, not on social media, but if you ask me right now, I can tell that the airport is supposed to be one of the most secure places in Istanbul because the government pays a lot of emphasis on keeping the airport secure. And the fact that this is happening at the airport means that the government is vulnerable in protecting its citizens and the intelligence services isn't functioning properly and they're not doing their job. So in terms of keeping the country safe, they haven't been successful.
Where do you see your home country heading right now? Do you think things are going to get better or worse?
Turkey has the worst geopolitical environment, and we have the Syria, we have refugees coming in, and we have the Kurdish problem, and we are doing good with our neighbor countries. I don't think we're heading into the right direction, but I think our recent news on normalizing relationship with Russia and Israel, these are good steps moving towards fixing our foreign policy, but we have a lot of problems in the country. The government is becoming more authoritarian, and these are major problems that are happening in Turkey. I am not precisely optimistic, but I want to stay hopeful and positive. The sad thing is people are hopeless. Back then, a couple of years ago, especially when the government came into power, people had hopes about going into EU, had real hopes about economic stabilization or becoming a democracy. But we're seeing these things happening again and again, and it seems like Turkish people are not hopeful, not excited about joining EU or even the possibility of having moving towards democracy. So there's a lot of hopelessness.
Given all of this, Safiye, is it hard for you to be here in the United States when all of this is going on back home in Turkey?
It's the holy month of Ramadan, and very sad that these things are happening. It's hard. My heart is broken. I keep staying in touch with my family there. I want to make sure they're safe, and I want to keep their hopes up.
It's hard, but you try to remain hopeful.
Absolutely.
Are you worried about how long it might be before you get back to Turkey again?
I'm worried about the future of Turkey, about my friends, but I hope that I can return back to Turkey as soon as possible. But I don't think it's very soon yet.
Safiye, who recently graduated from NYU, thank you very much for your time today. I hope you can get back soon.
Thank you so much.
A quick note now about British losers. And I'm not talking about Boris Johnson, one of the architects of the Brexit. Today, Johnson, who was tipped to be the new leader of the Conservative Party in Britain, did a 180. He said he won't run. So much for that. No, I'm talking about a perhaps more lovable British loser. His name is Marcus Willis, and the 25-year-old is one of the happiest men in Britain right now, despite the fact that he lost yesterday in a Wimbledon tennis match against the legendary Roger Federer. So why is he so happy? Well, because earlier this week, he was ranked 772nd in the world. But after coming through six qualifying matches to reach round one of Wimbledon, he emerged the ultimate underdog. Here's the crowd at center court as he walked onto the grass. And when Willis was positioned to win his first game against a 17-time Grand Slam champion...
Yes! You beauty! This thing has changed on center court. Marcus Willis storms to his first game.
He did play a strong match, but ended up losing in straight sets. But Willis, who teaches at a local tennis club and lives with his parents, was thrilled with his center court debut. Here he is talking to the press afterwards.
It's all just a blur. It was amazing. I did enjoy myself, even though I was getting duffed up. I loved every minute of it. Well, not the duffing bit, but I loved being there. I loved getting stuck in, fighting hard. The whole experience was incredible.
And the man who did the duffing, Roger Federer, praised his opponent.
Marcus brought some unbelievable energy to the court with the fans and then with his play as well and with his personality. So it was very, very refreshing to play against an opponent like this, who draws in the crowds and comes with some great shot making.
Willis is an unlikely star. He was nicknamed Cartman after the overweight character on South Park because he used to drink soda and eat chocolate bars during matches. That changed 3 years ago when he decided to get in shape and give the tennis thing a serious shot. But he joked with the press that he usually spends his Wednesdays teaching beginners how to play, not playing in front of 15,000 cheering fans.
Yeah, amazing. It's not my standard Wednesday, that. Next Wednesday might be quite different.
His short-term plan after his happy loss, grab a beer and chill for a couple of days. You are with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, and I have Patrick Cox of our podcast, The World in Words, here with me. I know you guys at The World in Words, Patrick, have been doing a bunch of stories on people who are trying to bring back languages. What have you got for us today?
Well, Marco, we got something just a little bit different. When you think of a language that is in trouble, it tends to be in a remote part of the world, at least not in big cities. It doesn't matter if the language is in Africa or Asia or right here in the U.S. with Native American languages like Ojibwe or Navajo. What we're going to hear about today is a language that does fit that profile, but the difference is it's also spoken and being documented in New York City.
All righty, here to tell this story is the world's Alina Simone.
A typical Sunday in Jackson Heights, Queens, and a Tibetan religious service led by crimson-robed monks is doing sonic battle with a Bangladeshi Americans for Bernie Sanders rally. Welcome to Diversity Square, the epicenter of the most diverse neighborhood in America. More than 130 different languages are spoken here, but many of them are from places so small, so remote, that they can get lost in the commotion. These teens are three of about 800 speakers here in the U.S. of Mustang, a dialect of Tibetan. Pima, Domaseri, and Domaseri, yes, same name, are cousins, and...
When we say Mustang, right, not many people get it. And if when we say Tibet, like...
They're like, oh,
that's China, basically.
Every weekend, they come to Jackson Heights to attend a Mustang school.
We go to Sunday school. In Sunday school, we get taught our cultures about it, because kids come here and they forget.
Cultures may differ, but teenage embarrassment is universal. Dialects like Mustang, also referred to as Mustangi, are waging quiet battles here for time, attention, survival. What exactly are they battling against? For these girls, you could say the pursuit of the American dream itself.
Their parents work 12 hours to 15 hours in the restaurant, in the nanny job, and a nail technician, you know. So they don't have much time for engaging with the children. And if the parents talk to them with the kids in Mustangi dialect, the kids are going to respond in English.
Culture and language activist Nawang Garung has become a custodian of Mustang here in New York City.
Language represents your identity, who you are. For if the Mustang dialects vanish, and it's slowly going to mean it's having a totally new identity.
These new identities are being forged by families who are part of a massive migration from the Himalayas, one that the earthquake in Nepal and the downturn in tourism has only accelerated. The result, especially for mountain people like the Mustang, has been...
a rapid population decline compared to other regions in Nepal.
Given the challenges of starting a new life halfway across the world, even when a language is spoken at home, learning it often has to be outsourced. Nawang's fear is that as the population of only 7,500 native Mustang speakers scatters across the globe, soon there won't be anyone to learn from. So together with the Endangered Language Alliance here in New York, he is working to create a kind of Mustang Library of Congress, a digital archive that will preserve oral history, folklore, and song handed down over hundreds of years. But oddly enough, Nawang's own journey to Queens from the Himalayan village of Giling actually began with an English word.
The only word we knew was chocolate at that time. We don't know alphabet, we don't know any numerals, but we know the word chocolate.
With his cropped black hair, button-down shirt, and hipster shoulder bag, it's hard to imagine Nawang as a 7-year-old sheep herder hoping to score sweets from a visiting foreigner. But one day he made a life-changing chocolate request from an Oxford professor who had come to his village to conduct fieldwork.
At that time, I don't know what's lie beyond the mountains, you know, the high peak mountains.
Within a year, he was living beyond those mountains, attending school in Kathmandu, while living with a British family. Eventually, he wound up as a graduate student at Dallas Baptist University, an opportunity that wasn't without its trade-offs. As one of a few thousand Mustang speakers in the world, he felt alone in Texas, very alone. Then one day he saw a car parked in front of his school with a familiar name and wondered who the driver was. He waited to see. You probably see where this is going.
I'm so excited to see this person. I thought this is from Mustang. I waited for 2 hours and then
two white women got in and drove away. Afterward, he went back to his apartment and Googled Mustang. Instead of finding his small Himalayan community...
Mustang, the original and the front runner, thundering along far ahead of the pack.
I never heard back in Nepal about Mustang the car.
In English, the two Mustangs sound the same, but they actually have nothing in common. The car was named after Mustang the horse, whose name comes from the Spanish-Mexican word mestango, meaning an animal that strays, whereas the Mustang Valley derives its name from the Tibetan word for fertile plain, smong thang. Anyway, 6 months after the Mustang misunderstanding, Nawang transferred to New York's Hunter College and moved to Jackson Heights, where many of the sights and sounds were familiar. Like the Sunday Buddhist service in Diversity Square.
It's not lonely. Even in New York City, it's all interconnected.
There are about 8,000 people here from Tibet and Nepal whose traditions are closely related to those of Mustang. In Jackson Heights, Nawang can grab lunch at the Himalayan Yak or buy books written in Tibetan. It's also one of the few places outside of Nepal where it's possible to conduct field work about the Mustang dialect and to bump into native speakers on the street. That's how I ended up interviewing the three young cousins, even getting them to sing on the street for me. Sorry, guys. Singing in Mustang, 7,000 miles from home. For the world, this is Alina Simone from Jackson Heights, Queens.
I'm back with Patrick Cox of our podcast, The World in Words. And Patrick, you guys did a live show last week. It sounds like it went really well.
Yeah, we were at the New York Public Library talking about language revitalization. We called it From Ainu to Zaza, those both being imperiled languages that have native speakers that are trying to bring them back.
And begin with A and Z, which is a nice bookend.
Indeed. We also talked about the Hawaiian language, and we heard from a musician, a speaker of Garifuna, which is a language spoken in some Central American countries, and he taught us to sing a little bit in Garifuna.
Barumugunyasayong.
Barumugunyasayong.
Natiwa. Let me hear it.
Natiwa.
Bohaliweyu. Let me hear it.
Bohaliweyu.
Iyuraguaba. Let me hear it.
Iyuraguaba.
One, two, loud, go.
I think we did okay, didn't we, Marco?
Yeah, that sounds like a whole lot of fun. I'm sorry I missed it, but, you know, had this little show to do up here in Boston. Anyway, you can hear the whole thing at the New York Public Library in the latest World in Words podcast. Go to iTunes or check out the World in Words page on Facebook. And Patrick Cox, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Marco.
Again. Now we're going to change key. That's how
you're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. Ray Kwong's father emigrated here from China, but when Alzheimer's began to take its toll,
my mother and my older relatives prevented me from even taking him to the doctor. The fear of humiliation is so strong and so crazy, you know, this old country mentality.
That story coming up here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Until this past Monday, Lilian Daoud was a host for the Egyptian station On TV in Cairo. Today she's in Beirut, out of a job. It's tough these days if you're a journalist in Egypt. If you criticize the government of Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, you're likely harassed, fired, or even imprisoned. If you're unlucky like Lilian Daoud, you're fired and kicked out of the country. I spoke with Daoud today from Beirut, where she's in limbo for the moment, and she told me her story.
I'm a British Lebanese citizen who lived in Egypt for the last year since 2011, a few months after the Egyptian revolution, and started working, as you stated, with the On TV. My TV talking show, it was a political current affairs, quite controversial, because I used to work for BBC for 6 years and a half before I joined the On TV. So I'm coming from a background where we were taught and learned that we have to represent all the parties of any issues that we are discussing. But these standards or the concept of representing all the parties, it doesn't seem that it does exist in Egypt as a concept.
Well, did you make some statement recently on your show, on TV, that caught the authorities' attention? And is that why you were deported?
No, actually, my program took off air like at least 5 weeks ago when the previous owner, Mr. Naguib Sawiris, sold the whole channel after owning it for about 15 years to another businessman who is pro-government and very close to the decision makers in Egypt right now. And it was expected that my contract will be terminated even before it's due in December 2016. That was expected. But what wasn't expected, that after the termination of my contract by 45 minutes, I was my flat was in Cairo, in Zamalek, was invaded by 8 plainclothes men claiming that they are from the passport office, and I have to go with them directly to the airport. I asked them to show me their IDs or their, like, the permit they have. They refused to. And I can say that I've been taken by force from my home in front of my daughter without even taking any of my belongings or finishing any paperwork or even get anything. I just left my daughter, Yani.
Right. Your 10-year-old daughter saw all this. Is she still in Egypt? And what's all this been like for her?
Yeah, actually, she's 11. Yes, she saw it all. She is traumatized. She's refusing to talk about the whole ordeal. And she wants to be with me here, which is going to happen, hopefully, in the coming few days.
Well, I hope you'll be rejoined with your daughter soon. Let me just get back to what's going on with On TV. I mean, they ended your contract. They're also a private media organization. Do you believe they came under pressure from the Egyptian government?
It doesn't make any difference, actually, whether it is private media institution or not. On TV was the last channel that was still at least trying to make a balance and not to be pro-government 100%. There was my program and another program, only two programs in the whole country that dared to discuss the political decisions and all what's going on in Egypt.
So you're saying now there are no independent broadcast outlets in Egypt?
No, I can say this and I can confirm it. There is no other program that is going to discuss the other point of view, let me say.
You, as you said, are a dual national, Lebanese and British, and I read the Egyptian authorities took your British passport. Do you see this move, this deportation of you to Beirut, as a kind of a shot across the bow to all journalists in Egypt, local and foreign?
Yeah, it was a message. I mean, this is the faith of anyone who would probably do not as we told them to do.
Lilian, what next?
Hope, pray, and wait for things to get better, to get my daughter back, to be able to continue my life, my career, do I believe in, to keep dreaming about better Egypt, about better Lebanon, about better future for our kids, not to see their parents being humiliated and snatched from their houses. The way my daughter had to see and had to live this very difficult experience.
Lilian Daoud was until recently a host for On TV in Egypt. She's now in Beirut. Lilian, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Michael.
Another story for you now about the politics and the press. Daniel Estrin has been in Germany covering stories about refugees and immigration for The World. And the story he's about to tell involves a political party there, the Alternative for Deutschland Party, or AfD. The AfD says things like, Islam has no place in Germany. But the party didn't start out that way. That's according to its former spokesman. Daniel knows him personally because they worked together for the show.
Frank Hessenland is a reporter for German radio. I met him a few weeks ago. We were working together on stories about Germany for The World. And then one day, he told me his story. In January 2013, Frank became a founding member of a new German political party focused on economic reform, Alternative for Deutschland, AfD. He joined early on. He was party member number 66, and he was hired to be the party spokesman in Berlin. But within a few months, Frank says, he was fired. And he got a tip that party officials had his personal email account with the party under surveillance.
They would spy on me because, you know, I was the press officer. I was liberal. I was pro-gay, in favor of a colorful society. So all this wouldn't fit.
This new party changed dramatically, says Hans Kundanani, a senior fellow at the German Marshall Fund.
What began as a professor's party has turned into a far-right, almost neo-Nazi party centered on concerns around immigration and multiculturalism.
So what happened? How did Frank, a freelance cultural reporter and former Greenpeace spokesman, end up in a, quote, almost neo-Nazi party? In the beginning, AfD was focused on one issue, the European financial crisis. The party had conservative views on the economy. It opposed Germany bailing out Greece and other European countries in debt. Frank says that's why he joined. He thought the bailouts would send Germany into major debt, and the government wouldn't have the freedom to make its own decisions on the country's budget.
I thought this is endangering not only the democracy inside Europe, but also the democratic structures in Germany, and I didn't like to lose them.
Frank says the party started with about 3,000 people. Within 2 months, about 12,000 more joined. Frank says he Googled some of their names and found some of them on watch lists compiled by German anti-fascist groups. Plus, he said he started noticing that some party board members displayed an unusually deep knowledge of Nazi tank models and military maneuvers.
You feel suddenly in a conflict that your political goals are definitely legitimate, but are your friends?
Frank would be at his desk working on press releases about the Eurozone and the Greek bailout when party members would find his number online as press officer and call him about membership matters. And then the conversation would sometimes take a turn.
They would say, you know, it's not even proof that we did the Holocaust. And even, you know, maybe we did something like that in the past, but it's exaggerated and the numbers are not correct.
You got a call like this?
Of course, yeah. Every here and then, maybe every 3 weeks, or 2 weeks.
These far-right party supporters had something in common with the party's founders. They were skeptical of the direction Germany and the EU were taking, but they were motivated by ultranationalism and social conservatism.
And so the liberal faction that had founded the party, they would think they could, as we say it in German, ride the tiger. But it turned out that the tiger would just throw them off.
When Frank wrote a press release saying the party welcomed same-sex marriage, a party leader declined to sign off on it. Then came the German federal election campaign in the summer of 2013.
Geben Sie Deutschland eine Alternative. Am 22. September Ihre Zweitstimme für die AfD.
At that time, left-wing critics were drawing Hitler mustaches on posters of AfD party members. Frank announced to the media that the party was liberal, not far-right, and that it would engage its critics in a dialogue. But he says AfD party officials did not agree with him. They fired him that very day. And then he said he found party officials spying on his personal party member email account. The guy who has Frank's job now at AfD in Berlin is Ronald Glaser. In an email, he said no one at the party intercepted or monitored Frank's private communication, and he denied the AfD had been taken over by, quote, extremists. He said, quote, "Once this year, we excluded someone from our ranks after he took part in an extremist demonstration, but this was a singular incident." Frank has left the party, but the party hasn't left him. Recently, another father on his kid's soccer team Googled Frank's name, found his old AfD affiliation, and then called him a Nazi to his face. And it wasn't just that guy.
Some Jewish friends, very close friends, actually would not wanting to have contact with me.
This year, the now far-right AfD party made landslide gains in German regional elections, the biggest victory of the far-right in Germany since World War II. The party has sharply criticized the large numbers of migrants and refugees arriving in Germany. Those immigration concerns have made it to Britain. There, they helped tip Britain's vote to leave the European Union.
This is going to change the whole atmosphere in Europe. This is my deep concern.
Another ex-party official who left Germany's AfD put it this way: "We have created a real monster." For The World, Daniel Estrin, Berlin.
The Tour de France gets started this weekend. It starts off in northern France with riders leaving the picturesque Mont Saint-Michel on the Normandy coast, then heads to Utah Beach, where Allied forces made the landing, on D-Day. It'll be scenic and windy, the pretty side of the tour, only to be counterbalanced by questions over the ugly side of the tour. Will it also be full of doped-up riders on doped-up motorized bicycles? I asked Ian Austin about that. He covers cycling for the New York Times.
I've been writing about doping at the Tour de France since about 1989. And while I think that there are now riders there and prominent riders there who do not dope. The problem clearly has not gone away. And of course, it now has this novel added dimension of mechanical doping using tiny motors and electric batteries or electric motors and batteries and bicycles.
As far as the performance enhancing drugs of the tour, is it a kind of wink, wink, nudge, nudge? Everybody kind of knows.
I think there are, you know, everybody suspects a lot of people. And of course, you know, at the Tour de France, there are two prominent teams, three, if you count Kazakhstan as, you know, a former Soviet state, that are backed by Russian owners. We've seen, we now know what happened with Russian track and field sports, thanks to Dick Pound. It seems fanciful to believe that Russian cycling teams are above it all.
And the mechanical doping, I mean, that's fascinating. That's a new development, as you say. Electric motors, increasingly hard to detect. How do they kind of run tests on that?
Well, there's a big debate about that. The International Cycling Union, because mechanical doping doesn't come under WADA's domain, has come up with this sort of magnetic resonance imaging machine. A lot of people, including Greg LeMond, the former American Tour de France winner, who everyone thinks was clean, think it's completely inadequate. I mean, they want to see a system sort of like when goods come into the United States, there are these giant X-ray machines on trucks, essentially, that, you know, that scan the entire container. There's some talk that it might be necessary for every bike to be inventoried at the Tour de France, corralled at the finish line, and gone over by this machine.
Does all this stuff ruin the sport for you?
Well, no, because I would have given up writing about it, I suppose. At some point, I would have smartened up. I mean, it's very, very frustrating and very disappointing. I am somewhat encouraged in that I mean, one can never be absolutely certain, of course, but I'm fairly confident that a number of the prominent riders at this year's tour are guys who are clean and they're competitive. It was very, very discouraging during the Armstrong era when basically you had to reach the conclusion that everybody was doping simply, in most cases, just to keep their jobs.
The great French cyclist Jacques Anquetil, who won the Tour de France five times, if he were alive today, what do you think he'd make of all this?
Anquetil was actually a proponent of doping.
Really?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, absolutely.
Had no idea.
Yeah, Anquetil, I mean, you know, doping was a thing that evolved. And Anquetil was quite outspoken and vigorously resisted the introduction of any kind of tests, was a proponent of using barbiturates and things like that. And although it's not really doping, he did a lot of advertisements for a cigarette company.
Oh, my. I think my childhood fantasy just got the air taken out of it.
Well, and Anquetil had that funny way of pedaling, too. So.
Yeah. All right. Ian Austin with the New York Times. Always good to speak with you. Thank you.
Likewise, Marco. Thank you.
Since we recorded that interview, by the way, French organizers upped the ante against motorized doping. They'll be using thermal cameras to scan bicycles at random points during the race. Those with a glowing red heat signature will be caught out. At least that's the hope. Vive la Tour. Question mark? You're listening to The World. The news this week of the death of legendary basketball coach Pat Summitt was made only sadder by the way she died. Early onset Alzheimer's. Anyone who has a loved one with Alzheimer's knows what a struggle it is to help them. But sometimes culture can make that struggle even more painful. 10 days ago, Ray Kwong lost his dad to Alzheimer's. Ray's father was 92. Ray Kwong wrote an essay for NBC News about how his family's Chinese heritage complicated how they dealt with Alzheimer's. Ray joins us from Los Angeles. Ray, my condolences to you, first of all.
Thank you, Marco.
Tell us first about your father, if you would.
Well, my father was an immigrant. He came over here from China in 1941. You know, to escape China. I mean, there was a lot going on at the time. There was a war brewing with Japan. There was a civil war within China itself. And his mother and father decided to send the four siblings to America one at a time, or at least that was the plan. My father was first onto the boat, a 3-week trip. He made it into Los Angeles. But World War II broke out, and the plan was trashed. In other words, the rest of the siblings never made it here. He never saw his mom and dad or his brothers and sisters again.
Wow. What was his name?
His name was Benny. And the funny thing there is, you know, he adopted that name you know, in the 40s, Jack Benny was a big name. And as everyone probably knows, immigrants have a habit of adopting an English name, and that's the name he chose.
How long ago did your father get Alzheimer's, and how did you, your mother, and the family react?
Well, he was diagnosed officially 2 years ago, but we knew, or at least I knew, he had Alzheimer's perhaps at least 5 years ago. And that's the gist of my article. I mean, the cultural baggage, the bias, the stigma, or the fear of the stigma, I should say, prevented me, and this is specifically my mother and my older relatives, prevented me from even taking him to the doctor. You know, the fear of humiliation is so strong and so crazy, you know, this old country mentality, that it prevented him from getting the meds he needed. It prevented him from, you know, even from the diagnosis.
So how did those conversations go within the family? Like, who was resistant and who was pushing, you know, 5 years ago to let's go see a physician?
Well, you know, I was doing the pushing. When I first noticed, for example, little dings on the front and rear bumper of my dad's car, unexplained. You know, he said, oh, I didn't hit anything. I mean, first it was flecks of paint, blue, yellow, red, whatever the case may be. Then came, you know, clearly he hit a fire hydrant. You know, it's things like that that make you scratch your head and say, hey, something's wrong. He could not remember things that you told him 5 minutes earlier. He would ask the same questions over and over and over and over again. Towards the late afternoon, in what is known as sundowner syndrome, he would call me repeatedly, ask me the same questions, or say, hey, Ray, I need you to come over and take a look at something. And I'd say, okay, I'll be right over. And then he'd call me 5 minutes later and ask me the same thing, as if he never asked that. My mother, at the same time, I'd tell her this, and she would constantly say, he's fine, he's fine. Here we are 5 years later. I think she knew something was wrong, but still to this day, she has never admitted to me, to the family, to her friends, to anyone, that my dad had Alzheimer's.
Do you have siblings, and what was their position?
Much the same. Yes, I have a brother, and, you know, his position was much the same. But, you know, me being the number one son and this notion, this thing of filial piety, you know, it was my responsibility to do what I had to do. Eventually got him to a doctor, eventually got him to a diagnosis. After a few years of pushing and pulling, you know, I did get my mom and dad into an assisted living facility where he would get his medication on a regular basis versus hit and miss, and he'd get fed, etc.
It took, I suppose, some pressure off your mom as a caretaker.
Well, you know, the crazy thing is I was the primary caretaker and caregiver, I should say. Because she did not think, or at least admit, that he had Alzheimer's, she acted as if nothing was happening.
I know you started researching the disease some time ago. I assume you were finding out what is Alzheimer's, but also were you checking into the cultural roots of acceptance, or rather not acceptance, of Alzheimer's back in China? And what'd you find?
In China, basically, people don't even know Alzheimer's is a disease. I mean, there are, I think, 9.4 or 9.6 million people with Alzheimer's estimated in China, and 90% of those people aren't even diagnosed. And part of the reason is the refusal to go to the doctor. In China, this dementia is actually known as old age dull-witted disease. So already, even by the name, there's a stigma attached. And nobody wants to admit that a relative has that disease for fear of humiliation.
Was there a generational split when it came to how relatives or people who knew your dad reacted to his Alzheimer's?
You know, with his friends and even older relatives, he could barely remember their names. When they'd go out, he couldn't order from a menu. He couldn't walk 10 feet without bumping into something. But at the same time, they'd say to me, hey, your dad looks great. You know, he's eating well. And eating well doesn't mean anything. But in Chinese, of course, it does. That means you're healthy. But I think they would ignore that, hey, something's wrong with Benny. Something's wrong with my dad. I mean, it was just like my mom saying, he's fine.
How much are attitudes towards Alzheimer's, especially among Chinese Americans here, changing? Like your generation, how will you be thinking about this differently?
Well, the response from my article has been overwhelming.
Well, it suggests that a lot of people find themselves in the same situation. So have you been giving advice, and what has it been?
Well, I've been prefacing everything by saying I am not a doctor, but you might want to do this.
Ray Kwong is a business consultant and a contributing writer to Forbes. You can read Kwong's essay about how his family dealt with his father's Alzheimer's at PRI.org. Ray, thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco. Thanks for having me.
Sound, and especially music, can be powerful connectors to the past. In the case of Jasmine Lee Richardson, delving into history was not about revisiting her youth. Jasmine goes by the stage name DJ Sun. Her project, called King Shi, is about digging into the past of one of her ancestors, a man named Sun Sam Sin, who left China in the 1800s as an indentured servant, destination South America, Suriname specifically. DJ Sun created a soundtrack for how she imagined that life and that voyage transpiring. What you're hearing now is a track called Shop. Sonically, it follows DJ Sun's exploration to historical areas in the region of King Shi, where her ancestor once lived. But Jasmine's research on this point got foiled because a shopkeeper, who was said to have some information, wanted money to reveal it. Like I said, it's an imaginary soundtrack. New music there from DJ Sun, her project called King Shi, after the region in China. And that is our show today. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.